Bush believes, he honestly believes, with God on his side and a B-2 bomber with angel wings in the sky, that he can rid the world of evil.
The concept of America as world empire, so controversial as to be almost unsayable just a few months ago, is now close to conventional wisdom.
It's very important, I believe, for the families to get back the body of their relative and then rebury him in a dignified way.
I think our technology has outrun our morality, and that we need to curtail this race to see who can be the most technologically proficient at killing.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, May 15th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Heavily armed U.S. Army troops stormed into a village near the city of Tikrit before dawn this morning, seizing more than 260 prisoners, including one man on the most wanted list for former Iraqi officials. U.S. troops encountered no resistance during the five-hour sweep, officers said. About 230 of those detained were being released later in the day, according to the military. Elsewhere, soldiers from the 101st Airborne Division shot and wounded a looter in Mosul after being fired upon. That's according to U.S. military officials. The shooting came one day after military officials denied issuing a shoot-on-site policy against looters. Defense Secretary Donald H. Rumsfeld said today American commanders are trying to determine how large a force is needed to create a secure environment for the people of Iraq, and he denied reports that U.S. forces had orders to shoot looters. That was hyperbole, Rumsfeld said. The rules of engagement for troops in Iraq have not changed. Rumsfeld said that the rules all along have authorized whatever use of force was necessary for self-defense and other selective purposes. Meanwhile, U.S. commanders began a new program to get more troops into Iraqi neighborhoods to help with garbage pickup, health care, and other services. The U.S. has come under fire by human rights groups for failing to remove unexploded cluster bombs littering the Iraqi landscape and leading to an undetermined amount of civilian casualties. The San Francisco Chronicle reports that U.S. troops have reportedly removed about 600 unexploded bomblets from the Baghdad neighborhood of Dura. It says, but unexploded ordnance still littering cities such as Najaf have become a source of strong resentment by many Iraqis towards the U.S. occupying forces. Jim Jennings, president of the humanitarian aid organization Conscience International, has made several trips to Iraq over the past 12 years to deliver food and medical supplies in violation of U.S. UN economic sanctions on that country. Speaking with Peace Watch earlier this afternoon, Jennings said that he's seen the effects of cluster bombs firsthand and that they have disastrous consequences on the civilian population.
I certainly have seen the effects of it, and I'm very concerned about it. This is not a new problem. It's not something that hasn't been discussed and demanded even of the U.S. military by a number of humanitarian aid groups over the years. My first encounter with these CBUs, as they're called, cluster bomb units, was in Beirut in 1982, and the young children would come and pick up those things and put them right in my face and say, look at this. They found it on the battlefield. But if they turned it a quarter turn to the side, it would blow up. And very dangerous. And that happened a lot in Afghanistan during the Afghan war. I was at the hospital when the children came up with their parents to the emergency ward, and the children were crying. One boy had his foot blown off, and the other girl, about 5 or 6 years old, had her eyes blinded. And I saw this. It was very heartrending. In Iraq, the number of casualties is escalating right now, and I have a report from UNICEF which says the problem of unexploded ordnance is becoming critical. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Myers, Richard Myers, admitted on April 25th that the U.S. dropped 1,500 CBUs, cluster bomb units, but he claimed that only 26 hit within 1,500 feet of civilian areas, and it was only one case of what the military euphemistically calls collateral damage, meaning killing a lot of civilians. We don't know how many in that case. But if you look at the reports that have come in from Iraq and Karbala from the 6th of April to the 3rd of May, cluster bombs killed a minimum of 35 people. on the 26th of April in Baghdad, two people killed by cluster bombs. 19th of April in Baghdad, three people killed by cluster bombs. They're laying on the ground, and people either stumble mm-hmm. over them or pick them up. Mm-hmm. So that this goes on and on. I could give you a long list, but the worst is in hospitals in Najaf, including cluster bombs, 224 deaths at minimum. Cluster bombs disturbed by children in Baghdad on 19th of April, three children died, and it goes on and on like mm-hmm. this.
Can you speak about how exactly a cluster bomb works and what makes it different from the other types of munitions?
Well, they're very long instruments of war, look like rockets. They're about the size of a typical water heater, but about three times as long. They are designed to come apart about 100 feet above the ground mm-hmm. and scatter little bomblets about the size of a coffee cup mm-hmm. All over the runway, the airport, or the roadway, or whatever else. A lot of these bombs do not go off on impact because they're like little triangles. Some of them look like batteries, but and there are about 200 types, but they're very devilish because they have a trigger on them that's supposed to set them off when they hit the ground. But if they hit on the wrong face, that trigger may not be triggered. So if a child comes up, and they learn to do this, and very innocently, they'll pick them up, and if they hold them straight, they're okay. But if you tilt them a quarter of a turn, they explode. So some of the boys learned how to do this from observing, and they are crazy enough to go and pick them up and carry them around. But there are others that explode if you touch them. So the main thing is they're very dangerous. They're lying all over the ground scattered, and they're on the surface of the ground. And what I saw in Afghanistan was so heartrending, and I asked the boy, the third boy in the trio, who had internal injuries, he said, well, we were playing, but they look like toys, and in Afghanistan, they dropped a lot of food packets, and the color and size of the bomblets looked just like the food packets, and the Army was called on this, and then they changed the color in the middle of the war. They're called anti-personnel units. They are designed to kill people.
Hmm. And so the food package resembles the cluster bomb.
Yeah, in Afghanistan, that was the way. Unfortunately, there was a lot of mix-up there. Again, they're just like shower of grenades that comes down on top of an area and scattered widely. And they're designed to cover whole complexes, like each one would cover maybe a half of a football field or size of a soccer field.
Mm-hmm.
And then they might throw 50 of those at one area scattered out at one time. So nobody could live within that area. So it's just a shower of grenades, and then many of them are duds or they are laying on the ground for a long time.
Mm-hmm. A reporter, one of our Peace Watch reporters in Baghdad, Aaron Glantz, relayed to us his story of visiting a home where the family was very carefully, very gingerly tiptoeing around a cluster bomb that was still sitting in the middle of their living room. And they had made several requests for the U.S. military to remove the ordnance, but so far they had not received any response.
Well, the problem with that is that, we don't have enough soldiers on the ground in Iraq to both maintain order and security and also do this unexploded ordnance kind of thing. I'm looking at a map right now of Iraq which shows unexploded ordnance in green, and it covers a good portion of the whole country, but especially around the main cities of Basra, Mosul, Baghdad, Kirkuk, and there are 10 million landmines in Iraq before the war, including about 100,000 that the U.S. placed on the Kuwait border, and then these 1,500 cluster bombs. But that's only part of it because there's a lot of other shells and rockets. And when I was there during the battle for Baghdad, in the middle of the road were lying trucks that had full of ammunition that had been blown up and exploded. But I'd say, 80-90% of the ammunition was still intact, even though the truck was lying on its side, scattered all over the road with the helmets of dead Iraqis. And that we saw a couple of truckloads like that, which you have to drive around them, very close to them. And it's expensive to clean this up. And, of course, we haven't even mentioned the problem of depleted uranium, which is I don't think there's enough money in the world to clean up all of the depleted uranium that the U.S. Dropped in the first Gulf War.
Well, let's talk about that. How much is out there? How costly would it be? And is it actually possible to clean up that much depleted uranium once it is released into the atmosphere and the environment?
Well, I received a report that says that the United States refuses to get involved in the cleanup of that, and part of the reason for that is that over the next 50 years it would cost as much or more than the war itself. it would be very difficult to do. I attended some meetings with the medical staff in the Basra Hospital and in Baghdad at the medical school, and the incident rates for birth defects and for all types of congenital malformations have escalated sharply in the decade or more since the Gulf War. That also is true for leukemia and cancer in children. It's so alarming that there's no way that you can avoid the conclusion that there's some effect on the environment of these all these bombs that were dropped.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible to clean up all the depleted uranium from an environment?
I would think that it would be impossible, because what the Iraqi scientists have been saying for some time is that now it's in the water table, it's in the dust that's settled on the desert. There are certain areas, and I've seen this these maps of the incident of children born to soldiers born with defects. Like, I've seen them with no heads, no eyes, with a huge spinal bifida hole in their spine, all kinds of misshapen bodies of children. That this wave of births like that came several years after the Gulf War, because it takes some time for the effect to come out. So in the 19th century, the people who died in warfare were mostly warriors or combatants. In the 20th century, most of the people were civilians. In the 21st century, it will be the descendants of the people who were in the war zones, the children who haven't even been born yet when the war is ongoing, and that's certainly a crime against humanity.
Mm. And what about the American men and women soldiers that are actually in that area where this depleted uranium is being used? They, too, will be subject to these lingering effects?
Yes, and the Gulf War veterans groups have pointed this out vociferously and have gotten the Pentagon to back down numerous times on their claims. And so, therefore, the U.S. Army has learned something since that time. Every soldier who is returned home now has to be tested, I think, blood and maybe DNA and everything else, to see what his status is when he was demobilized, in order to counter, I think, not to help them so much, but to counter the claims that they know they're going to make when they start walking into walls and can't remember their names and losing the hair on their head, as happened to some of the veterans from the Gulf War. But hopefully that will not develop, but the experience shows that that is going to happen.
Mm. Okay. Dr. Jennings, we thank you so very much for your time and your perspective. Any final thoughts on your part?
Well, I just think that we have to look at the victims. On the same day, Sunday, the April 25th, that General Myers was saying, we launched 1,500 of these cluster bombs, which have each of them up to 200 bomblets inside them. But we only think that there was one case of so-called collateral damage, I mean killing civilians. We don't know how many civilians. On that same day, the Los Angeles Times reported the case of a 14-year-old boy named Nabil Khalil in Kirkuk, who played with a cluster bomb. He found in on the ground there, lost a hand, suffered severe face injuries, and can barely open his eyes. If you look at the victims, you will say that these weapons are inhumane. They should be banned along with weapons of mass destruction, and they should be banned along with chemical and biological weapons. Why not? And landmines as well, which are killing people every day in this world. So it's a very serious issue. I think our technology has outrun our morality, and we need to curtail this race to see who can be the most technologically proficient at killing.
Jim Jennings is president of the humanitarian aid organization, Conscience International. Thousands of mass graves have been found in the town of Hilya and many other cities throughout Iraq. The BBC reported this week that most of the graves seem to have been dug in the early 90s after the Gulf War, but others are much more recent. We go now to Baghdad. Peace Watch spoke with Nada Doumani, a worker with the International Committee of the Red Cross in Baghdad today, regarding the graves and what she has witnessed over recent days.
The situation is very dangerous, very serious in Iraq in terms of explosive remnants of war, and that's what we call ERW. And this includes not only the cluster bombs, but also all the abandoned armored vehicles, the abandoned small arms and light weapons, abandoned ammunition stores, mines, all kind of unexploded ordnance. And all of them constitute a serious threat to the civilian population throughout Iraq. Just yesterday, we've heard reports about at least 6 children have been killed in a single incident in Al Amara, which is in southern Iraq, playing with one of these ERW.
6 children were killed. So apparently these materials, these bombs, live ammunition, I guess, live devices are clearly accessible to children.
Absolutely, and I just mentioned 6 children in one single incident. And apart from that, there are probably many more incidents going on. And as you said, these are accessible. We've even heard that there were some cluster bombs in schools in Baghdad. Some people told us this. And I don't know if you remember two, three weeks ago, there was a huge ammunition dump inside in Baghdad and a rather residential area, and it was when the coalition forces, more specifically the U.S. forces, were trying to detonate these ammunitions that we've had, I don't know how many people killed, 6 to 7 people killed and over 40 injured, because this ammunition dump was like a warehouse inside the capital. So in fact, unfortunately, all these explosive remnants of war are lying in populated areas.
And these cluster bombs and devices are obviously left over from the invasion, this most recent invasion of Iraq, and used by the U.S. and British and allied forces. Can you tell us how they would go about removing them?
Now, the thing is, it needs, of course, some expertise, and definitely it's the responsibility of the coalition forces as occupying power to protect the civilians and ensure their safety. At the ICRC, our role will be mainly, and is, and we already started that, doing a huge awareness campaign, awareness program, by informing and educating the population about the danger of ERW, by distributing safety messages, making use of public media, establishing a network in the affected communities, but with the help of the Iraqi Red Crescent Society, etc. But we cannot do any clearance. The clearance should be done by experts, and I believe coalition forces do have the means for that.
We also have seen reports and been told of Iraqis who are desperately seeking to get information about their loved ones who may have been killed in the invasion, in the recent invasion, and have taken to digging up graves that have been dug in front of the hospitals. What can you tell us about that, Nada?
Well, yeah, unfortunately, it seems that almost every single day, if not every single day, maybe every second day, there is one mass grave uncovered somewhere in the country. And the latest one was in Hilla 2 days ago, and apparently there are hundreds, some people say even thousands of bodies lying, have been buried here probably in the early 90s. More precisely in 1991, and yesterday a team from the International Red Cross went there, and in fact, it was a very moving scene, seeing all these people, hundreds of people, thousands of people coming and trying to dig with their hands in the soil to recover the bodies of their relatives who went missing, trying to identify the bodies. Fortunately for some of the bodies carried on still the IDs and were easily identified. Unfortunately, all this process was done in a very anarchic way, which means that maybe others won't be able to identify their relatives because the bodies would be damaged, are going to be damaged in this process.
So help us to understand exactly what's going on. These are mass graves that were dug in the early 90s by whom?
Well, definitely it was at the time by the previous government. In 1991,
the Baath Party.
To media reports, this corresponds to a period when there was a Shiite uprising following the 1991 Gulf War. We didn't investigate on that issue, but all reports are converging and say that this comes back to 1991. We're really hearing plenty of stories. Just to mention also, we have plenty of people now missing from this war. Apparently, there have been also some people who were killed during this latest war and were just buried also very quickly in different places. And we have people coming every day to the office telling us stories also about looking for their relatives who went missing during this last war and, of course, the previous years of the Baathist regime.
And so when they dig the bodies up, do they rebury them in proper graves?
Yeah, well, that's the whole aim. I mean, normally, you know, it's very important, I believe, for the families to get back the body of their relative and then rebury him in a dignified way. At least maybe that would help them overcome their suffering.
How many of these mass graves are there?
Well, you know, it's hard to count them now since 4 or 5 weeks. Every second day there is a mass grave. Well, a mass grave, sometimes it's maybe few, maybe more uncovered in some places, maybe few bodies. It will, at this stage, I think it's too early to give a precise number and know exactly what happened.
You said hundreds of people are buried in these graves, or thousands? Or?
Well, in Hilla, only just in Hilla, apparently. BBC even reported 15,000 at one point, so I don't know. But, I mean, it's difficult for us to say. In order to be credible, I mean, we didn't count the bodies. But some people say 15,000, some people say 5,000. We've seen a few hundred, but just in one side, because they were not all in the same place. They're all around Hilla.
Nada Dumani, spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross, speaking with us from Baghdad, Iraq.
I saw a woman's face in the paper. She was from Iraq. I was looking at her, and she was looking right back, and her eyes still haunt me. Over all of the distance, such a human insistence, demanding answers and asking questions. How can you do this? And why don't you do something to stop it? These briefcase killers, these bureaucrat thugs, these pushers of bullets and runners of drugs, these colonels and statesmen, these newspaper drones, this idiot system, this heart of stone. Don't look, don't see, don't hear, don't think. Sit back, relax, have a smoke, take a drink. Go to work, come home, watch TV, watch the game. Let them breed dead babies in your ignorant name. And their eyes still haunt me. Over thousands of miles, millions of agonies, reaching, reminding, and tearing the blankness. How can you do this? And why don't you do something to
Jim
stop
Page.
It?
Since waging a unilateral war on Iraq without seeking renewed UN backing, the U.S. has come to be seen by many international observers, even those in the mainstream, as an imperial power. The concept seemed controversial just a few months ago, but now it's been adopted by the right wing and mentioned on the op-ed pages of major newspapers across the country. Jay Bookman, deputy editorial page editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, has been following the discussion, and he offers this reflection.
The concept of America as world empire, so controversial as to be almost unsayable just a few months ago, is now close to conventional wisdom. The topic is featured regularly on the covers of national news magazines. It's discussed in popular books. It's celebrated on newspaper op-ed pages. In fact, some of those who once shied from the word empire, even as they advocated policies to that effect, now embrace the label. "We need to err on the side of being strong," says Bill Kristol, the neoconservative editor of the Weekly Standard and chairman of the Project for a New American Century. "And if people want to say we're an imperial power," Kristol says, "that's fine." That newfound candor reflects two realities. First, the fiction that we are not an empire had simply become impossible to sustain, and not merely because we now occupy Iraq. Just recently, news broke that the United States would be building new military bases in Romania, Hungary, Poland, and Bulgaria, all former Warsaw Pact nations. In addition, we already have troops in more than 130 nations by the Pentagon's unofficial account, permanent bases in roughly 40 of those countries, basing rights in many more, with ambitions to expand still further into places such as the Philippines and even Vietnam. Second, in the warm and fuzzy aftermath of military victory in Iraq, the need to be coy about our intentions has evaporated. Triumph has a way of making people feel, well, triumphant. Many who previously shrank from the concept of empire now find it attractive. Many who found it attractive but feared public reaction now feel free to be more honest. It is fair to say, though, that this reality has caught most Americans unprepared, and for good reason. In the case of Iraq, we were sold war against Saddam Hussein on many different grounds, including an alleged close link with al-Qaeda that has yet to be documented, and the alleged presence of hundreds of tons of chemical and biological weapons, none of them yet found. In reality, it is now clear that we fought this war to place ourselves in the midst of the Middle East in a very big way. In part, we hoped to try to drain the swamp of Islamic terrorism. In part, we were motivated by concern for our oil supply. And as a report by the Project for a New American Century stated in September 2000, quote, "While the unresolved conflict with Iraq provides the immediate justification, the need for a substantial American force in the Gulf transcends the issue of the regime of Saddam Hussein." Unfortunately, the true scope of U.S. ambitions to remake the Middle East in our image was never articulated beforehand to the American people. As a result, the Bush administration has committed this country to a major international obligation without having the buy-in of the American people needed to support it. Even the administration itself seems torn by the resulting schizophrenia, rhetorically embracing the difficult work ahead while shrinking from the actual task itself. While the president notes that, quote, "The transition from dictatorship to democracy will take time, but it is worth every effort," administration officials admit they don't have enough troops in Iraq to maintain order today, and still talk in terms of reducing troop levels by 75% to roughly 30,000 by the fall. While Pentagon officials acknowledge that our military manpower is stretched thin by Iraq and the demands of empire elsewhere, we obstinately refuse to ease that burden by inviting the United Nations to help in policing Iraq. And while we boast with good reason about the high-tech weaponry fielded by our military, at last report the Civilian Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance in Baghdad doesn't even have working telephones a month after we occupied the city. We are, in other words, a half-hearted empire, pleased with the power and prestige it brings, but unwilling to spend the money, time, and manpower to manage it. And half-hearted empires have a very short life expectancy.
Jay Bookman, Deputy Editorial Page Editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.